I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You got up this morning, you took a shower. As you stood there dripping on the bath mat, you reached for the towel, the one with the Fieldcrest label. Well, that's a towel which used to be made at the big red brick Fieldcrest plant number 1 in Kannapolis, North Carolina. Those towels are now being made, more cheaply, in China. Over 5,000 people lost their jobs when Pillowtex, Fieldcrest's parent company, went out of business. North Carolina is a classic example of America's manufacturing job drain. Over the past few years, 140,000 workers have lost their jobs in the state's textile industry alone. Millions of American manufacturing workers who used to make cars and shoes and chairs are also out of work today. In this hour, we're concluding our series on the state of work in America. We will talk with business owners in North Carolina, and we want to hear from you as well, Connection listeners. Because the politicians are talking about trying to slow job losses in manufacturing. Are they going to change anything? Can they do anything? And what impact is the loss of manufacturing jobs having, not just on workers and their families, but on communities and American society? The number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be talking in just a moment with Barry Bluestone. He's been with us in our series this week. He's a professor of political economics at Northeastern, director of its Center for Urban and Regional Affairs. But we want to start in North Carolina. Steve Dobbins is the president and chief executive officer of Carolina Mills, and he's joining us from his office in Maiden. Hello, Steve.
Good morning, Dick. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
I understand that just 4 years ago, you had 17 different plants running, 2,600 employees. What does the picture look like today?
Well, that picture has changed radically, Dick, in that time. Today, we have about half. We've closed 10 plants, actually have 7 plants left, and have about 1,300 employees. So we've lost half our company in this last 3.5, 4-year period of time.
What is it that your company does, Steve? What do you make?
We are a kind of a medium-sized textile company. We make yarn and fabric and do dyeing and finishing. You don't normally see our products as a finished product, but you'll see our components, for instance, like Polar Tech, Polar Fleece fabrics. We make yarns that go into that. We make fabrics for work gloves that you find in the hardware store, so those type of things.
Okay,
textile processing.
Those things, the Polar Tech and the gloves, they're still being sold in hardware stores and department stores. Where's the thread coming from now?
A lot of the thread, Dick, as much as the actual products. If you look at the products themselves, they're being late. Look at the label. They're made in China, Pakistan, India,
right. Some
cases South America, other places, so not in this country. So we've actually seen our customers go away. You mentioned Pillowtex, I think, in the opening, where there was a customer that we supplied products to, and obviously that's a terrible situation. So we've seen with the, I guess, slow economy and this unbridled growth of imports that are just coming from everywhere, just literally decimate our business in the last 3 or 4 years.
Now, forgive me if this is a silly question, but if you're making the thread and the material that people need to make these products, is it even conceivable that you could export that to China so the manufacturing firms in China would still be using your product?
Well, as you've heard throughout your series here, one of the key problems is the currency, the way things are set up in China. It's almost impossible to ship any products out of this country anymore with our monetary policy and the currency differences that we've had. It's almost impossible. We do some exporting on selected products, but it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, if you look at how exports have dropped out of this country. So that would be a nice thing, but it does not look like that's going to happen.
And I guess wages is another big part of the equation, that the Chinese workers are working for a great deal less than workers in America.
I'd like for your listeners to understand that's just very small. We hear that all the time, but we can actually show you where we can put zero labor cost in our products and not be competitive. So that tells you that there's many more things going on there. You've got a communist subsidized government. You've got currency situations. So it's way beyond just that. Obviously, they'd have some advantage just on that, but there's certainly much more to the picture here, monetary and trade policy.
Steve, what does it look like in the neighborhood where you live and the places where your plants were operating? Are there homes being closed as well as businesses?
Foreclosures are up big time. Let me just go back and tell you, for your listeners, we've been in operation since 1928. So for 75 years, we've been here, and for 72 of those, we grew and prospered and did very well. So if you look now at the small communities around us, where we've closed plants and how that's been affected, shop owners, small shop owners, barbershops, folks like that are being affected. So we're having actually businesses close, and has a tremendous impact throughout the whole community. So it certainly is not just the plants only, but it certainly has a devastating impact on the small communities, particularly where we're located. Unlike most of your listeners, about 30% or 40% of the manufacturing jobs is what we do here. We have a very, I guess we're blessed with a great workforce, honest and hardworking people. So manufacturing of textiles and furniture and even fiber optics have been here. So it's hit us particularly hard because we have probably two or three times as much manufacturing. You can imagine the ripple effect that that has had in the community.
Steve, I wonder if you can stay with us for half a sec, because I'd like to bring Charles Saunders in. Charles is president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia. He's standing by in the studio. Hi, Charles.
How are you this morning, Dick?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I understand that you're feeling the same kind of stress that Steve's been describing. How are things for the Saunders Thread Company?
Basically the same as Steve is talking about. We have seen in the last, especially the last 4 years, a dramatic drop in our domestic business. We are probably more in the export market than Steve is. We make a lot of specialty and technical products that are still not available locally from many of the foreign countries.
You're talking about a Kevlar thread and a Nomex thread, the heat resistant and the stuff that goes into things like bulletproof vests, right?
That's correct. And safety apparel for firefighters, oil field workers, chemical factory workers, utility workers, that sort of thing.
Now, was there a time, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago when you sat down and had a business meeting and said, we need to get into this kind of specialty area, or we need to kind of lock down on this specialty area because of the threat from all the Asian businesses?
Originally, our decision to get into these products was not a direct result of the imports. We're a very small company. We have currently 40 employees manufacturing our products. And being small, it is obviously very hard to compete against some of the gigantic or large textile companies, the ones that do have many plants, thousands of employees. And we were looking at it originally from that angle, which, as it turned out, was a smart move with the way the industry, the domestic industry, has gone.
Do you think that that smart move is going to see you through these particularly difficult times? Are you confident?
Confident, I don't think, is a word I could use right now. It depends on what our government is willing to do. I know Secretary Snow was in China about the trying to get the Chinese to float the yuan, to let it get to a more realistic value. They basically told him, we'll think about it, but not now. What we do on some of our trade policies, you know, it's a toss-up right now.
Charles and Steve, you're both in the same business. Do you guys know each other?
Sure do.
Yes, sure do.
Go ahead and say hello. It's good to have you both.
And Charles, good to hear.
How are you, Steve?
We're still surviving. We sound like you are, too. That's good. We're hanging in there.
Tell me.
Well, we've made it through another week.
That's right.
Phew. Are you counting it in weeks?
Literally, that's the case. I think in some cases we had some more plant closings announced in our area yesterday, other companies. And, again, you mentioned the large Pilatex. The Pilatex was like 4,500 to 5,000 people in North Carolina. 7,000 altogether, the largest layoff that ever hit the state of North Carolina, came around August the 1st, so that's sort of a shockwave that's still coming. But then some of the plants supplying those folks, there's some collateral effects and damage, so it's still kind of a week-to-week situation.
I wonder... Go ahead, Charles.
I was going to say the largest spinning company in the world, Parkdale Mills, which is located in Gastonia, had 27 plants. They just announced this morning that they were closing two of those plants, probably as a result of Pilatex. But Gaston County alone has had over 7,000 jobs lost just so far this year.
Steve, one thing, Dick, just to throw in there, your listeners, that this we didn't just suddenly forget how to make yarn or a hosiery, whatever, after 75 years. So there's definitely some things. There's the pace of how this is happening so fast and across the manufacturing spectrum is not coincidental. You can trace it back to what I call special causes. I've been in the business for 35 years. We've been fighting imports and cheap labor for 35 years. It's always been the case, but we've always been able to automate and innovate and do those type of things. But with the monetary policy and trade policies of the late 90s and certainly in the 2000, 2001 and what's going on right now is why you're seeing such a sudden surge across all the manufacturing areas and why you're beginning to see service jobs like IBM's computer jobs, all your bank backroom things, government things are beginning to move. So this thing is much bigger than just the manufacturing. It's certainly going to spread to other parts of the economy. So this is the biggest oxymoron I've heard is jobless recovery. And most of the folks I'm looking in the eye after 25 years and telling them they don't have a job, it's not a recovery if you don't have a job. So this is actually a job loss recovery, and the first time since Herbert Hoover that we've had 4 years with a negative job growth. So this is a serious situation, and I believe it's certainly going to spread to the service and other parts of our sectors without some sort of change.
Let me hear from both of you about what you see ahead in North Carolina for your kids, for your workers, if there's not a change. Steve, do you want to start?
Sure. Let me give you some examples of just some of the people that we've watched go out of jobs. We've tried to place employees in other plants. We have other plants. That's been one thing. Some of them have gone back to school, a very few of them. Many of them are taking another job. And in a lot of cases, those jobs, the government counts a job, a retail one and manufacturing. But those jobs are about half the pay with no benefits. And if you follow their life and what we see here to a natural conclusion, it is a lower standard of living in this country. So what you see happening based on just what we're seeing, and again, the numbers sometimes misleading because a job is a job in the numbers, but that is the actually trading down in terms of their salary and the benefits. And so that tells me the way we're going as a country, certainly in this area, but I think across the country, is a lower standard of living for our people, and we're not happy about that.
Charles.
Well, I agree. We certainly are not happy. One thing that I recently came across, manufacturing jobs, for every manufacturing job, it creates 3.72 non-manufacturing jobs. For each non-manufacturing job, it creates a little less than one additional job. So with the loss of manufacturing, it's not only affecting manufacturing. It's not just a textile issue. It's across the board. It's going to affect people in, no matter what they do for a living.
I'll take this moment to thank Steve Dobbins, Chief Executive Officer of Carolina Mills, for taking the time to be with us on the program today. Steve, it was good to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Charles Saunders, we'll be back talking with you a little bit more when we come back. We'll also be hearing from Barry Bluestone, who's been sitting in the studio, taking notes, listening to the conversation so far. Connection listeners, we also want to hear from you. This is not just a North Carolina issue. This is a national issue. 1-800-423-8255 brings you into the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support.
Connection listeners, you're listening to stories today on the program that are not just business stories. These are personal stories about people's lives and jobs. Steve Dobbins from Carolina Mills, 75 years in the business, now half the number of employees that he had just 4 years ago, losing some 1,200 employees. Charles Saunders, 36 years as president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia, North Carolina, still in business, struggling, though, and wondering what's ahead. The manufacturing sector in this country is facing the sort of risks that it has never seen. Barry Bluestone is in the studio with me. Barry, you're a professor of political economy at Northeastern University, and I know that this state in particular is one that you look at, that you study, that you teach people about, because it is an example of what may lie ahead.
Well, we used to talk about this in Massachusetts and New Hampshire in the 1920s and the 1930s. Many of the industries that started in New England moved down to North Carolina and South Carolina beginning in that period. The thread industry, the textile industry, the apparel industry. We lost the jobs in New England. They gained them there. Now, North Carolina, South Carolina, other parts of the South are seeing those same jobs first going to Mexico, and now they're going to China. And so we see this kind of globalization of the economy constantly affecting different parts of the world. Right now, it's very much focused
on North
Carolina and South Carolina.
And you're saying let's stick with North Carolina. It's a great deal. There's more to the story than the textile industry.
Oh, absolutely. You know, just since February of 2001, just a couple years ago, North Carolina has lost over almost 128,000 manufacturing jobs. That's one out of six manufacturing jobs in North Carolina have disappeared in just the last couple of years. Since 1995, it's almost 220,000 jobs. So they have been seeing a dramatic decline, the kind that Steve Dobbins and Charles Saunders have been talking about on the small scale is happening all over North Carolina and in other states. 220,000 jobs since 95, 128,000 jobs since February of 2001. Take that to the national picture. Since February of 2001, we've lost 2.4 million manufacturing jobs in America. That's 14%, or one out of every seven manufacturing jobs has disappeared in America since February of 2001.
Now, Charles, when I talked to Steve about this and said, is it just because you're paying your workers, I don't know, $15 an hour and the Chinese workers getting 50 or 60 cents an hour? He said, no, it's not a wage differential, and we always make that mistake. What do you think about it?
Well, it's not just the wage differential. In many instances, as Steve said, you can remove the labor cost out of a product and still not be competitive. There are a lot of things that go into that. People in the U.S., they want clean air, clean water, safe working conditions, retirement benefits, health benefits. All of this is added into the cost, too.
All right, let's talk about that specifically. You have health and safety regulations that you have to meet. You have EPA regulations that you have to meet. Workers' compensation, health care, all those sorts of things. Those are expectations that every American worker and the American government places on you as an employer, right?
That's correct. And I feel that, that it's a reasonable. I'm not saying we should do away with any of those. I think our employees, we have very good, very skilled employees. They deserve all of the benefits that that we can afford to give them.
But Barry Bluestone, when you talk about a plant in China or Mexico, I guess for that matter, which doesn't have to meet any of those expectations placed upon the Saunders Thread Company, then the equation, the notion of free trade becomes one that's very hard to find, to level.
Absolutely. I mean, the problem we have is, at least since the 1930s, even before that, in the United States and in virtually all developed countries, we've developed a whole set of regulations of the labor market and of the economy. The minimum wage laws, child labor laws, the right for workers to join a union. And then, of course, environmental laws that we began in the 60s to improve our standard of living. And we believe these are now sacred. These are important. And they are, as Mr. Saunders points out. The problem is we now have a global economy in which the trade is going everywhere, free trade. But our competitors don't have the same set of rules and regulations, nowhere close. The result is that you have this very unbalanced playing field where even if you took out the labor costs themselves, the set of regulations and rules, since they're not international, really go to the detriment of American firms and their workers. What we need to do is to take free trade, but also balance it with international rules and regulations. And that's something we've not done, and it's one of the major problems with the trade legislation we have, is we went to free trade, but we didn't realize we also had to put in place a set of fair trade laws that covered things like minimum wages, environmental standards, and so forth. And what we should have said to the rest of the world was, if you play by some fair rules, and they're not going to be the same as ours, but at least some leveling of the playing field, then we can have some kind of free trade with you. But you have to play by some rules. Well, games without rules aren't very fun to watch, and they're very dangerous to play.
Charles, what were we thinking? I know that the senators and the congressional leaders from North Carolina were among those supporting free trade. Were they not thinking about the issues we're talking about here? Were you not telling them about it at the time? What went wrong?
No, we have been extremely vocal with our representatives in Washington. Of course, we just lost one of the best we had up there, Senator Jesse Helms. Whether you agree with his politics or not, he was very much working for the people in the state of North Carolina. We have some good folks up there now. It seems that party politics has gotten involved to a great deal on it, supporting the president. Of course, a lot of this began with NAFTA under Bill Clinton, and now with some of the trade agreements with Vietnam and the normalization with China with George Bush. And it appears that the politicians are supporting their party rather than their constituents.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Newburyport, Massachusetts, and Liz is joining us on the phone. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Well, I was actually a Pilotex employee until about a week ago. I worked in a sales office up here in Massachusetts. My sister told me this program was on, so I tuned in this morning, and I don't know, I just wanted to kind of give a perspective from the someone who knows what's going on up here. I think a lot of people in the Northeast are not, you know, don't tune into this in the same way that people who live in the South, whose daily lives are affected by this. You know, I think people up here, doesn't affect us as much, but we need to have it affect us. We need to pay more attention to this because it really does. It affects this whole country.
Steve Dobbins was saying a little earlier in the program, Liz, that a manufacturing job, a job on the line, will cause a whole lot of other jobs to be created. I think his number was 3.7 something or other. But I mean, you're an example of that. That we shouldn't just focus necessarily on what happens in a plant in North Carolina. Do you think that the people in this country, that the politicians running this country, are getting the message?
I think they get the message. Whether they're doing anything about it is another story. I guess personally what I take away from this whole experience, which has been absolutely one of the saddest things I've ever been through in my life, seeing this company die, is that, you know, we're being talked to out of both sides of these politicians' mouths, and it's rah-rah-rah USA on the one hand, and on the other hand it's but please look the other way while we, you know, ship all these jobs off to other countries. It's pretty sad. One of my customers, who is a major retail chain in this country, the day that we declared bankruptcy, July 30th, she said to me, "It's a sad day for America." And I thought that was about the best way you could sum this whole situation up, really, Pilotex specifically.
How long had you worked there, Liz?
I only worked there for 4 years, which for me was a lot, but, you know, I certainly knew plenty of people who, I talked to one lady, she said, "I came to work here when I was 18, and I expected to be here for the rest of my life." And it's pretty heartbreaking to listen to that kind of thing. So it's been a very, very sad experience.
You know, Liz, what you've been experiencing and the others at Pilotex is something, of course, that has happened for years and years to people all across the country, but particularly now affecting people in the South. But what is interesting is that somehow a decade ago or so, we started thinking, well, we could live without manufacturing. We once had 30% of American jobs were in manufacturing. We're down to about 11% today. And we thought, well, America is so strong, our productivity is so great, our technology is so great, we can have a post-industrial society, a post-manufacturing society, in which we'll do just fine. We can let all the manufacturing go abroad. Well, what you've learned and what Mr. Saunders and Mr. Dobbins were talking about and what we're learning every day is that manufacturing is absolutely critical to the country because so many other jobs are tied to the manufacturing sector, and also because manufacturing is exactly what gave us middle-class America. Manufacturing was the base for a middle-class America. What we had were jobs that were better paid with good benefits, more strongly unionized. What we're substituting for it is an unequal society where we have some very, very good jobs that pay six figures, but we have even many, many more jobs in which manufacturing workers are falling into part-time jobs at poorer pay with fewer benefits, and we're destroying the middle class when we destroy the manufacturing sector.
Charles Saunders, is that a fair description of what you're seeing happen in North Carolina?
Definitely. As I said earlier, our local county, Gaston County, has lost 7,000 jobs just in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. These are manufacturing jobs. Our city is full of empty, boarded-up manufacturing facilities. We're seeing very little new industry come in, even though the county and the city are working very hard to bring in new industry. All of the new industry is going to places like China and India and so forth. So it's not going to help the people that were in the middle class, which is the majority of our area.
All right, Liz, thank you for calling in from Newburyport. Let's go to Spokane, Washington. Now Linda's joining us. Hi, Linda.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you for calling.
Sure, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask how consumers are supposed to know when they're buying American-made and when they're buying something woven somewhere else, manufactured somewhere else, and then maybe finishing touches put on in the United States. My great-grandmother used to always say, buy union-made, buy U.S. label, and that was an adamant rule in our family for a long time. We all have to do the best we can with what we have, but sometimes we have choices. You look at three sets of towels, how do you know which towel was made? And if we can vote with our money as consumers in this country to support our own manufacturers and
right.
workers, how do we do that? How do we know that?
Linda, it's a great question. Charles, it must be something that crosses your mind when you look at the people lined up to go into Walmart. I mean, those people are looking for the cheapest towel. Is it their fault that these jobs are disappearing?
Well, it certainly doesn't help the situation, and it's a two-edged sword. You hate to begrudge people buying products at low prices, but at the same time, when they do buy those products that are made in other countries, it's going to affect their job. As far as how do you know where these products are made, our government has labeling laws, and each item will have a label showing where it was made, if it was made in its entirety in another country or in the U.S. It'll say made in USA, or it may say made from U.S. fabric assembled in mm-hmm. Mexico or Indonesia or wherever. So they are required to put labeling to indicate 100% or partial manufacturing in another area.
You know, the next time you're in an auto dealership, go and take a look at the label, which tells you the fuel economy and the price. That label will now tell you what proportion of the value of that car is built in each country. I was recently in a Mazda dealership, and that's now built in Flat Rock, Michigan, and something like 52% is in North America, U.S. and Canada, 19% is in Japan, 32% or whatever the remaining is in Mexico. But what it suggests is that there is no such thing any longer as made in the U.S. It may be assembled in the U.S. from parts elsewhere, or it may be U.S. parts going abroad. We have a globalized economy in which more and more products are made everywhere. But the problem is that over time, we're going to lose more and more of that total business unless we get some kind of fair trade arrangements internationally.
So does it make sense for Linda to wonder whether or not buy, as Charles suggested, you know, looking at the label saying made in Myanmar with thread from America, that could be a short-term stopgap solution to what's going on here? Is that going to stem the flow of manufacturing jobs out of the United States?
Barry? I don't think that's going to do much to do it. You know, the real major problems are large economic problems and large political problems. We have had a policy of a very strong dollar in the United States. That means we wanted to have a policy where our dollar was very strong, it made imports very cheap, and it made our exports very expensive. What it did do was it kind of kept inflation under control, something the monetary authority, the Federal Reserve Bank, wanted to do, and what the president wanted to do, both Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush. The problem is, if you get the dollar so strong that it's impossible to export, and it makes it so cheap to import, we get these tremendous trade deficits of $500 billion, and with every dollar of trade deficit, we lose jobs.
But you and I both remember a time when the great fear was that Japanese investors were taking over all the businesses and all the manufacturing in America. There was at that time a Buy America campaign. It did re-energize to an extent the car-making industry in America. Can that kind of political move about Buy America, does it have any traction in 2003?
It has a little bit, but not much. Buy America is a good slogan. Look for the U.S. label. It's a good slogan. But what we need to have are new policies in Washington and, in fact, new international policies that really take into account the full globalization of the economy that we're moving toward, that provide for the development of underdeveloped countries. We want other countries to develop along with us so they can eventually buy our products. But we have to do it in a fair way, and we're not doing that now.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. As we continue our series on the current state of work in America, we're talking about the decimation of the manufacturing sector and wondering whether or not politics or business has any answers for what the country's facing now. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. President Bush is spending this week crisscrossing the nation, and he's talking about troubles with American manufacturing. An unexpectedly grim government report that came out today shows people struggling to find jobs, even as some areas of the economy are recovering. The president addressed the issue of job loss yesterday in a speech to workers in Kansas City, Missouri.
It's hard to feel confidence if you're somebody looking for a job. People have been hit hard in the manufacturing sector know what I'm talking about. Parts of this country are not doing as well as they should. Regions like the Pacific Northwest and parts of the Midwest. Part of the current problem is that job creation lags behind improvements in the overall economy. Of course, it takes a while for job creation to catch up.
1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation about the situation facing the manufacturing industry in America today. Straight to Raleigh, North Carolina. Sue's on the line. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
You listen to the president, and
yep.
Are you confident that he's focusing on the issue here?
No, and you know what? I have a job, and I don't feel that confident. And unless that we address the lack of fair trade laws now, right now, I really don't see when our country will get that confidence back. And I don't know why our politicians don't realize that manufacturing is the pulse of this nation. When can we start before? And I agree with Charles that was talking earlier. This is certainly hitting the manufacturers hard. But where will it stop? And, you know, in my home, I have a 14-year-old and 11-and-a-half-year-old. We went on a mission in our home to find something made in the USA. I thought for sure my Kenmore washer was made in the USA. Well, it wasn't. We finally found a pillowcase made by Martha Stewart in the USA. And it took us probably 15 minutes.
What was their reaction to that kind of a hunt that you went on, Sue?
Well, they were very surprised, but it was a realization to them that most everything we have is no longer made in this country. The calculators that we had to have for them for class, notebooks, just so simple, simple objects also, not just the more technical objects, but it's just a shame. And something has to be done about it now. I think we are at the tip of the iceberg.
Well, is that something that has to be done about it, something that the consumers need to address, Sue? Will that little hunt through your house change the way that you shop now?
You know what? We tried it for a week. Unfortunately, the demand that is there and the lack of the American goods, if you look at the clothing, you cannot go into stores and buy American-made clothing. You can't find it. And as I was saying, you know, when we got the list sent home from school of what the children had to have, the calculators, they're not made here. So it is very difficult at this point for the consumer to follow, you know, buy American. It is almost impossible for us to do that and have and purchase what we need to have. So I think at this point it's going to have to be addressed on the political level.
Sue,
and it needs to start now.
All right. I want to thank you for your insight into that little free trade scavenger hunt. I appreciate you calling in. Let me go to Charles Saunders here, because Sue ended by saying this has to be addressed politically. And Charles, I wonder from your perspective, someone who is trying to preserve a business and preserve jobs, is that, do you share that same sentiment?
Certainly do. That, in my opinion, is the only way we're going to get a change. The only time the politicians seem to pay any attention to us is when they receive letters, emails, phone calls, and then they get very concerned as we get closer to Election Day.
Okay, but what do you want people to tell them? Do you want to set up some kind of Fortress America where, you know, if there's going to be a towel sold in this country, it better be a towel made in this country? Is that the answer?
No. We are a global economy today, and whether we like it or not, that's not going to change. We don't want it to change. We don't want to go back to the 20s when we had restrictive trade rules and ended up with the trade wars and the Great Depression. But what we want is not free trade, but fair trade. For example, the United States has completely honored its commitments to eliminate a lot of quotas. We're moving forward 2005, January 1. All quotas on textile products will be eliminated. In the same agreement with China joining the WTO, they have not removed any and don't show any signs of
doing it. Let's just talk
about our government doesn't do anything to enforce the trade agreements.
So what options are open, Charles? Secretary Treasury John Snow, he goes to China this week, as we pointed out earlier on the program. The Chinese yuan is pegged to the dollar. The American business needs to have that change, wants to see the Chinese currency floating. Snow makes the case to the Chinese. The Chinese say, thank you for your input, no, and goodbye. What can change?
Our government is going to have to take the action that if the Chinese are not going to live up or any country, not just bashing China, but if the country we have a trade agreement with is not going to abide by that agreement, then we need to enforce that agreement. If it means we put increased tariffs or quotas on products from those countries until they open access to their country, you know, the government has to do that. I can't do that as an individual business owner. My employees can't do that.
But you're a voter.
It's our government.
Right. You're a voter. They're voters. That's where the pressure comes from, right?
Yes. My company can't vote, but I can vote and all of my employees can vote. And I assure you that they're not going to vote for the people that are giving their jobs away.
Barry Bluestone.
Well put, Charles. The fact is, you're right. It is a political issue now. 10 years ago, we were all free traders. Now we're starting to see politicians backing away from it. We have to keep their feet to the fire. What I think they failed to recognize was that sooner or later the economy would slow down, and when it slowed down after 2001, these imports were going to slaughter us. Now they understand that, and they understand it, I hope, in next year's November election, that we're going to have to really deal with the trade issue. We're going to have to really deal with manufacturing up front. There have been some members of Congress, some senators, Jesse Helms was one of them, Dick Gephardt on the Democratic side was somebody who fought for fair trade over and over again. We'll see what kind of things he has to say in this presidential election. I think, though, one of the very interesting things all this week on this special program about the American worker and the American labor force is that all of these things start to tie together. The growing inequality of America, the threatened middle class, the fear that even workers with the best skills are being affected by this. Over 500,000 of the manufacturing workers who've lost their jobs since February of 2001 are people who are not blue-collar workers. They're white-collar workers. They're executives. They're high-skilled technicians. This is affecting everyone, as Sue pointed out. We see the job insecurity of the skilled workers, and then, of course, on Wednesday, we saw the way this is affecting people who are the most disadvantaged. Finally, we have to get the politics right. Finally, we have to bring some new economic sense to our political policies in terms of trade, in terms of globalization, in terms of technology. If we don't do that, we face a very, very insecure future.
Charles Saunders, I wonder if I can get you to comment on a little study that someone did in North Carolina. They were looking at retraining, which is one of the buzzwords that the politicians often use when they talk about finding an alternative to manufacturing jobs. And here's what they did. They looked at 50,000 workers who'd been fired. They found out that about 11,000 of them went into a retraining program. Some of them dropped out, so there were about 9,000 left. And of the 9,000 who stuck with the retraining, only 2,000 of them actually got work. So, I mean, do people see that as a lost, as a useless alternative to what comes next? Is retraining got anyone talking in North Carolina?
Well, the problem we've had in North Carolina with retraining is what do you retrain for? They had a program up in the Raleigh-Durham area, Raleigh, the state capital. There were a lot of computer-related businesses up there. So they retrained a lot of former textile manufacturing people for jobs in those computer businesses. Those computer businesses have moved to India.
Which is
the
something.
People are retrained, no jobs.
We actually talked about that on this series earlier in the program. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's an interesting link. To High Point, North Carolina now. George is joining us. Hi, George.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. I'm kind of frustrated with some of the verbiage that I've been hearing from your panel and some of the people that are calling in. I'm in the furniture industry,
Yep. And
my profession of 30 years has gone down the tubes.
What do you do, George?
Basically, I'm in the furniture industry as a product development person. I do master hand carver is my background, and that has gone overseas to China and other places. No way I can compete with those folks. I've had to go back into a different phase and find something else to do. Basically, it's been as a consultant. But I get frustrated when I see people talking about giving away jobs. What politician wants to give away jobs? What manufacturing executives want to give away the jobs? They don't want to give away these jobs. They've been fighting like crazy to try to hold on to them. It bothers me when we take a look at it from that standpoint.
So, yes, so what's missing here, George? What needs to be done?
I don't know that I've got a solution for it, but I certainly don't think that we're going to find a solution by casting blame on the people that are affected by it, such as the factory owners and executives in any one industry. I don't think the politicians can do much about it. This is like trying to legislate. You're asking about legislation. It's like trying to legislate against a hurricane that's coming.
How old are you, George?
Oh, I'm in my 50s.
And you're out of work now, right?
Well, basically, it's gotten to that point. I am in a different field now, staying with the same industry, working as a consultant. Basically, I've had to decide whether to fight them or to join them. And I'm working primarily overseas as a consultant, trying to get our products the way that we want them over here.
I want to thank you for your call and ask Barry just to comment on that kind of transition and whether or not that's not one of the routes that people are going to have to take.
Certainly it's one route, but it's not going to be true for millions and millions of people. One point that I wanted, that George brought up is we can't legislate this. But that's not really true. In the 1920s and the 1930s, we did legislate, and it made a big difference in what the American living standard was like. The minimum wage laws we talked about, the right to join a union, child labor laws, fair labor standards which set overtime hours and so forth, environmental protections, those can only be won through the legislative process, through the political process. What's been missing here is the lack of an equivalent set of legislation which could be globalized, that could start in America but go broadly, that would bring us into the 21st century. And until we're willing to do that politically, we're going to suffer the losses we've seen all week.
As Charles was saying, set the rules here, make sure that the others stick to the rules, and then there's a level field upon which to compete.
Exactly.
Barry, thanks so much for being with us through this series. Nice to have you helping us with it.
Wonderful to be here.
Barry Bluestone's a professor of political economics at Northeastern, director of its Center in Urban and Regional Affairs. And Charles Saunders, I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Charles Saunders is president of Saunders Thread Company in Gastonia, North Carolina. Earlier in the hour, we also spoke with Steve Dobbins, president and chief executive officer of Carolina Mills. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation on our website. We are at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Matson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, Doug Sugart, and Dan Zoll. Our intern is Kate Zarnowski. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.